Part 3 of 13 from set number 2005, introducing C.G. Jung's Red Book, a BC Recordings copyrighted presentation by Stefan Heller entitled Jung's Red Book, Book 1, Chapters 6 through 11.
And with that, we'll now address ourselves to the Red Book, beginning at Chapter 5, which is entitled Descent into Hell in the Future. And I will read a little portion of that for you at this time, and right at the beginning of the chapter. In the following night, the air was filled with many voices. A loud voice called, "I am falling." Others cried out, confused and excited during this, "Where to? What do you want? Should I entrust myself to this confusion?" I shuddered. "It is a dreadful deep. Do you want me to leave myself to chance, to the madness of my own darkness? Whither, whither? You fall, and I want to fall with you, whoever you are." The spirit of the depths opened my eyes, and I caught a glimpse of the inner things, the world of my soul, many-formed and changing. I see, now comes the vision, or at least portion of it. I see a gray rock face along which I sink into great depths. I stand in black dirt up to my ankles in a dark cave. Shadows sweep over me. I am seized by fear, but I know I must go in. I crawl through a narrow crack in the rock and reach an inner cave whose bottom is covered with black water. But beyond this, I catch a glimpse of a luminous red stone which I must reach. I wade through the muddy water. The cave is full of the frightful noise of shrieking voices. I take the stone. It covers a dark opening in the rock. I hold the stone in my hand, peering around inquiringly. I do not want to listen to the voices. They keep me away. But I want to know. Here something wants to be uttered. I place my ear to the opening. I hear the flow of underground waters. I see the bloody head of a man on the dark stream. Someone wounded, some slain, floats there. I take in this image for a long time. Shuddering, I see a large black scarab floating past on the dark stream. In the deepest reach of the stream shines a red sun, radiating through a dark water. There I see, and the terror seizes me, small serpents on the dark rock walls, striving toward the depths where the sun shines. A thousand serpents crowd around, veiling the sun. Deep night falls. Thick red blood springs up, surging for a long time, then ebbing. I am seized by fear. What did I see? Indeed, what did he see? Well, he does not explain it right here at all, except some pages later. He refers to it as he does to quite a bit of the material in the subsequent chapters in a 1925 seminar, and connected much of it, much if not all of this vision, with the image of the death of the hero, later also manifest as the death of Siegfried. Jung connects the corpse floating and its surroundings with the death or destruction, as he puts it, of the hero of the ideal of his, that is Jung's, efficiency. This would indicate that he had to let go of his self-image as a clever, efficient, skilled psychologist, and to so simplify his attitude that he could truly take advantage of the instruction he is to receive from his soul, as he has already indicated in the earlier chapters. He then prays to his soul to allow him to free himself from the burden of his knowledge and his worldly cleverness and judgment. I am stunned, but I want to be stunned, since I have sworn to you, my soul, to trust you even if you lead me through madness. How shall I ever walk under your sun if I do not drink the bitter draught of slumber to the lees? Help me so that I do not choke on my own knowledge. The fullness of my knowledge threatens to fall in on me. My knowledge has 1,000 voices, an army roaring like lions. The air trembles when they speak, and I am their defenseless sacrifice. Keep it far from me, science, that clever knower, that bad prison master who binds the soul and imprisons it in a lightless cell. But above all, protect me from the serpent of judgment, which only appears to be a healing serpent, yet in your depths its infernal poison and agonizing death. I want to go down cleansed into your depths with white garments and not rush in like some thief, seizing whatever I can and feeling breathlessly. Let me persist in divine astonishment, so that I am ready to behold your wonders. Let me lay my head on a stone before your door, so that I am prepared to receive your light. These words are addressed to his soul. I am particularly struck with the expression divine astonishment, which in one of his earlier manuscripts is called blessed astonishment. So we can be instructed by our soul only when we can silence the cacophony of previous knowledge, our conditioning from the past, including scientific knowledge, and above all judgment that excludes so much experience. He certainly reminds me in his, let's say, in his eagerness to free himself from past knowledge and from past judgment of the late Krishnamurti, who was very intent upon teaching the same, and who always said that past conditioning by way of our thoughts, by way of our theories and ideas, stood in the way of the new and more important and more enlightening kind of inner knowledge. A very, very important, no doubt controversial subject he brings up at this point is the idea of divine madness. Therefore, consider the event from outside, always sees only that it already was, and that it is always the same. But whoever looks from inside knows that everything is new. The events that happen are always the same, but the creative depths of man are not always the same. Events signify nothing. They signify only in us. We create the meaning of events. The meaning is and always was artificial. We make it. This one was actually not about the divine madness. But let's say the divine madness, let me just see where I can find that. This is, when the desert begins to bloom, it brings forth strange plants. You will consider yourself mad, and in a certain sense you will in fact be mad. To the extent that the Christianity of this time lacks madness, it lacks divine life. I think that's something that we, once again, one of those slogans that we should paint on a very large flyer and distribute it to various churches. Maybe we could have an airplane pull it, in the air. the note of what the ancients taught us in images, madness is divine. Take note of that. But because the ancients lived this image concretely in events, it became a deception for us, since we become masters of the reality of the world. It is unquestionable, if you enter into the world of the soul, you are like a madman, and the doctor would consider you to be sick. What I say here can be seen as sickness, but no one can see it as sickness more than I do. This is how I overcome madness. Now, this is important. If you do not know what divine madness is, suspend judgment and wait for the fruits. But know that there is a divine madness which is nothing other than the overpowering of the spirit of this time through the spirit of the depths. Speak then of sick delusion when the spirit of the depths can no longer stay down and forces a man to speak in tongues instead of in human speech, and makes him believe that he himself is the spirit in the depths. But also speak of sick delusion when the spirit of this time does not leave a man and forces him to see only the surface, to deny the spirit of the depths and to take himself for the spirit of the times. He's talking about both. When we identify with either of these, then we are not at the right place. The spirit of this time is ungodly. The spirit of the depths is ungodly. Balance is godly. Because I was caught up in the spirit of this time, precisely what happened to me on this night had to happen to me, namely that the spirit of the depths erupted with force and swept away the spirit of this time with a powerful wave. But the spirit of the depths had gained this power because I had spoken to my soul during 25 nights in the desert, and I had given her all my love and submission. But during the 25 days, I gave all my love and submission to things, to men, and to thoughts of this time. That was during the day. At night, he spoke with his soul. In the daytime, he spoke to outer things. That's important here to remember. Thus can you differentiate sick and divine delusion. Whoever does the one and does without the other, you may call sick since he is out of balance. But who can withstand fear when the divine intoxication and madness comes to him? Love, soul, and God are beautiful and terrible. The ancients brought over some of the beauty of God into this world, and this world became so beautiful that it appeared to the spirit of the time to be fulfillment and better than the bosom of the Godhead. The frightfulness and cruelty of the world lay on the wraps and in the depths of our hearts. If the spirit of the depth seizes you, you will feel the cruelty and cry out in torment. The spirit of the depths is pregnant with ice, fire, and death. You are right to fear the spirit of the depths, as he is full also of horror. Now, divine madness. The concept of divine madness has a distinguished history, which goes back to the ancients and particularly to Plato. I have on many an occasion, in connection with other subjects, quoted Plato here, where he says that what we need to a very great extent is the mania, the divine madness. And so it's really a tradition that comes down to us a long, long time and for some very distinguished sources. It is, of course, at least in the usage of Plato in the ancient Greek, it is a synonym for what? For an altered state of consciousness. Of certainly a certain kind. Jung also brings to our attention that while divine madness, in this case the upwelling of the spirit of the depths, is of great importance and great utility, one can succumb to it entirely, and then it can become just sick delusion. He poetically states that for 25 nights he was in the spiritual desert, and he was dealing unreservedly with the spirit of the depths. But in the daytime, he was working with what we might call the ego world, the spirit of this time, and that this kept him in balance. So we should not lose our footing in this world while we are allowing the inner world to enter our consciousness. And he indicates here that that is what he did, and that is how he survived in a, in a psychologically sane manner. Then Jung comes back again to the theme of the murder of the hero, as he continues in this chapter, and he elaborates further a bit on his previous vision, which we read last time. Here he becomes strongly prophetic, and he comments poetically on the tendency of people to engage in regicide, the killing of rulers, the killing of kings, whom he represents here as archetypal, or let's say they are the representatives of archetypes in the public arena. You need to keep in mind that when he wrote this just prior to World War I, there were a heck of a lot more crowned heads about in the world, and especially in Europe, than since then. And he wrote this chapter apparently about 5.5 months after the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand, an event that started World War I. By the same token, his statements are prophetic also concerning other regicides, such as the murder of Tsar Nicholas and his family by the Bolsheviks, and the destruction of numerous European monarchies after World War I. And he's telling us here, I'm summarizing other portions of this chapter, he's telling us here that people are really trying to kill whom? They are trying to kill the ruler, the hero, namely, today we would probably say, at least in part, the ego within themselves. But since they are psychically blind, they do this externally, and thus the true purpose is not accomplished. He calls the regicides, the revolutionaries, blind prophets. They see something true, but the way they are going about it is in blindness, because the task that calls forth to them and that they really ought to accomplish is within them. But instead of that, they project it outward, and they bring about or facilitate various changes of a revolutionary nature. They cause various upheavals in the outer world, and none of that is really of any great use. And so we have to perceive the fact that the real creative events occur within ourselves. Outside events are really not creative, but just because of their lack of ability to accomplish the truly intended result, they become repetitive. And so we look at history and we see the repetition of certain events again and again, and we may tend to agree with a certain poetess who said that life is not just one damn thing after the other, but the same damn thing over and over again. That, of course, is not mentioned by Jung, but it is implicit here. But here is really, you might say, the deep psychological reason for it. So we need creative developments ourselves. Ultimately, we need a radical transformation within ourselves. But we place our hopes in outside events, and thus the events and the people within the events disappoint us. Then he comments quite obviously on the war, being World War I, that, and I quote, "People fall on their brothers with mighty weapons and bloody acts." Certainly very, very true of World War I and of World War II. "They should sacrifice the hero in themselves, but because they do not know this, they kill their courageous brother." This is also exact quotation from Jung in the book, in the Red Book. So in the latter part of this chapter 5, he points out that when people individually or collectively, as the term was used later on in depth psychology, live out the internal necessities of the psyche, instead of letting them happen within themselves, they are not going to change. Only the external events will happen. He intimates that through the blood sacrifice of the war, which he foresaw, collective spiritual or rather psycho-spiritual developments will ripen. And so as much as he disapproved of the tremendous bloodshed, he also saw it as a collective psychological blood sacrifice, which may help to ripen some further developments, further transformation. Of course, we know now that one of the unfortunate consequences in many ways of the war, of World War I, was what? Was World War II. Maybe not so much of the war, but of its aftermath and of the extremely counterproductive arrangements by way of so-called peace treaties and such, that various countries were oppressed and impoverished and infuriated, and this of course then permitted some very pernicious archetypes, which Jung spoke about of course at a later time, such as those of the National Socialists, of the Nazis, to come forth and take over. He also shows here that as the heroes are slain, great darkness will rise from the collective and also will do further terrible things, so that the war is not going to be the end of the horrors. The important issue that he discusses here is, of course, that most political events of any kind, not just bloody warfare, not just regicide, not just terrorism, to use a term of more contemporary relevance, but that political events are most often projections of interior psychic movements, and if this is not recognized, then the real change, the real sacrifice, does not happen, because that one must be inside of us, and when we do not see that, and when we purely engage in these actions outside, then we have completely missed the point. So the conclusion to be drawn from all of this is that we must be thoughtful, we must have the ability to turn inward and to look at ourselves, that there must be an insightful self-observation and ultimately self-knowledge, because only by way of such qualities can the great upwelling movements of the psyche properly express themselves and become productive of some desirable ends. Change for change's sake is just as unproductive as the lack of change for the sake of lack of change. And really all we have to do is just pay attention to our own lives a little bit more and the way we conduct our affairs, how much we live out the internal necessities of our psyche and then have to repeat this over and over again. And then we can see how this works at the individual level and how it works at the collective level. But I think it's certainly remarkable, along with other statements, that right before the outbreak of World War I and in the early phases of World War I, Jung saw so clearly what was taking place in a depth psychological manner and also what the results of these developments would be. Now we move on to chapter 6, which is entitled Splitting the Spirit. In this chapter, Jung manifests much conflict. And this we find in certainly in this part and pretty much I think all through the Red Book, that certainly his experiences were not taken just with some sort of utter placidity and navel contemplating serenity by Jung, but that he had tremendous reactions to what he was experiencing, and much of that reaction was in the nature of conflict, of terror and of confusion, because he very clearly confesses to the fact that so many of these experiences, so many of these visions really did not yield their meaning to him until much later, a good deal after he had them. And even his commentaries and his explanations were not written at the same time when he wrote down the experience. That came later. So it's important to keep in mind that really the entirety of this book, among numerous other things, is a record of Jung's transformation. It is the record of his essential change from one kind of an individual, from one kind of psychological state and orientation to the other. And as we go through the various chapters of Book 1 and Book 2, we are really following the process that Jung himself undergoes. Now that's the main line that the book follows. But of course, along with that and within that, we have innumerable insights and innumerable explanatory statements which have great and general applicability. And that is why it would not do to just take from the book the portion that pertains to Jung's transformation and leave the rest of it out. But at the same time, we need to keep in mind that what we have here is really the story of an individual, the story of an embodied consciousness that is undergoing a tremendous transformation, tremendous initiation, which if we move along correctly, I will show you at the end of this evening's talk in the form of the great initiation that he undergoes, which is at the end of Book 1. So that is something to keep in mind. The conflict, therefore, is there. His arguments are there. His questioning is there. He is being assailed in the desert, in this case, by monstrous magical beings who attach themselves to him and change his very form. He also complains of the great darkness he finds himself in, and he cries, "To journey to hell means to become hell itself." The spirit of the depths then dialogues with him, albeit cryptically. The two great primal duality which appeared at the very beginning of the book in the very first chapter, the spirit of the depths and the spirit of, not just the spirit of time, it's the spirit of this time, dieser Zeit. Okay? These two are in conflict with each other and are trying to come to ultimately to a creative reconciliation. And that is sort of really the underlying background of the entire process of transformation. That just like all the rest of us, for a long time, he feels even though I'm sure that he was a lot more creative in that respect and had a much more permeable psyche than any of us, that he addressed himself to the world of ego, to the world of external concerns and interests, and that eventually the spirit of the depths, you know, very profound force and energy of the deep archetypal psyche erupted and broke forth. And then the great interaction of these two taking place, of course, within his psyche began. And there is the poor fellow, you know, just being caught up in this terrible back and forth, in this terrible process, and not knowing, at least for a long time, hardly what is going on, but at least in spite of his argumentation and so forth, having the wisdom to persevere and not to interrupt this. And so this always comes up again and again, that great duality. You can also discern kind of prefigurations of the later fate of these insights, of many of these insights and this material, when he translated the process that is explicitly stated in a direct manner in the Red Book into alchemical symbolism, as we know. Because the ultimate fate, since this book was not published, the ultimate fate of the material disclosed here was that he, after receiving the Chinese alchemical treatise of the Golden Flower from Richard Wilhelm, he got the inspiration that this process, which he himself went through and which he recorded in the Red Book, can be seen in the symbolism of alchemy, and that he could communicate it in that fashion to a large number of people who perhaps would not be able to deal with the material of the Red Book, as assuredly I think they would not have been. So it's, at least in my opinion, and that's just an opinion, there is a kind of underlying synchronistic and magical mystical reason why this book has been published at this time. And that is that this is the time when at least a goodly number of people will be able to deal with this material. That sort of at our own individual levels. And if this had been published soon after it was written in the 1920s or so forth, certainly its reception would have been of a very, very different nature. So this is really in many ways a kairos, as the Greeks would call it. This is the time when the gods are reborn. This is the time when the great architects come forth. And in many ways, this is the record of their activities. This is their sacred book. This is their mirror. And that is probably why this has become available to us now rather than that on other time. But I'm getting ahead of myself. As the spirit of the depths dialogues with him, here is an example. Jung says to the spirit of the depths, the archetypal force, "You weave the thickest darkness, and I am like a madman caught in your net. But I yearn, teach me." Now, you know, so sort of get the spirit of that, you know. What is happening is terrible, it's disturbing to me, it's breaking me down, it's dark, it's horrible, but you know what? I yearn, teach me. I am not going to get out of it. I am here to stay. I am here to persevere, because that is how this process will be completed. And it's really that perseverance and that courage, really heroic in its own way, not in the external way, but in the internal way, that made Jung who he was and that enabled him to do what he did. His soul answers him saying, now he speaks to the spirit of the depths, but the soul picks up the conversation, and the soul says, indicating, don't be so impressed with all that darkness you are talking about. My path is light. And to Jung's argument, the soul then replies further, when he says, well, it, maybe your path is light, but I don't see it in so many words, then the soul answers back, my light is not of this world. So the balance of this chapter consists in voicing parallel developments in the events of the world, in the history of World War I, and of the individual struggle to slay the ego prince inside. And with that, we move on now to chapter 7, very, very important chapter, the murder of the hero. Jung now sees himself in a vision, and here I'll summarize because I think it's easier done that way. He sees himself in a vision in the company of a young, small, brown man, and they are in the high mountains, which of course is an image not difficult to come by in Switzerland. You know, I lived in a place for 5 years very similar to Switzerland in the Austrian Alps, and there too, you, wherever you look, mountain, mountain, mountain. You know what, you get kind of tired of it after a while. that's why I settled in the nice sort of pastel-colored hills of Southern California, without snow. But that is a little bit beside the point. So there they are in the high mountains, and they seem to be hiding among the rocks. Now, along comes, who do you think? Siegfried, the blond Germanic hero whom, a few decades prior to that, Richard Wagner made very popular all over Europe, the blond Germanic hero who appears in a chariot. The chariot is made of the bones of the dead, to make it a little more impressive, but that comes from the mythology. The Jung and his short companion fire at him at close range and kill him. And then Jung, with his usual ethical qualms, feels very guilty and disturbed, and he feels like he really ought to kill himself next. But the spirit of the depths comes to him and utters the words, the highest truth is one and the same with the absurd, which is what he said before. So, in other words, look for the deepest underlying meaning and don't get thrown off with the wildness and the absurdity of the imagery. And this statement pacifies to some extent the great guilty turmoil in Jung. And then this is the description, and it, when I was studying it, I said to my friend, this is such a typically Swiss image. Here are these two rascals, Jung and his shadow, because that's how it turns out, sitting up in the mountains, and then there is a narrow passage between the rocks, sort of a narrow road, and there comes Siegfried, his chariot, great triumphant expression on his face, his blonde hair probably flying in the wind, and boom, boom, they shoot him. And finish him off. Because that's the kind of thing that the Swiss will want to do in their history. In the famous drama by Schiller, Wilhelm Tell, that is how they get the evil governor of Switzerland when they say, through the Gasse Muster kommen, through this narrow place he must go. There is no other way through here. And then they kill him. So he has sort of picked up, let's say, on the ancient customs of his nation, of killing people on the mountain roads. So his commentaries then turn again to the recognition that people do not know that they should kill the gods in themselves. And the way he puts it is that gods, when they get old, their form no longer expresses their meaning and their life, and then they have to go. The editor quotes several passages from the unpublished notes called the Black Book, which indicate that Jung came to recognize that Siegfried was a complex figure representing his ideal of force and efficiency. Those were the words used in the Black Book. What he has done here, he deposed his superior function in the killing of Siegfried. By the way, I am sure that in some of the literature you may have come across all the attempts of various writers and biographers and so forth who tried to interpret this, because the dream of Siegfried, the dream vision of Siegfried's slaying, he allowed to come out. He spoke about that at some time. And so they said, oh, that was the image of how that was a symbolic statement of how he did away with his master Freud. Now, if you have any idea of what Sigmund Freud looked like, you know, here's this slender, dark-haired, very Semitic-looking gentleman, very good-looking man at that, you know, and so forth. And so this is Siegfried coming down in the chariot with his blonde hair. Come on, give me a break. Such a change would not occur. They certainly were. Then others said, no, it wasn't Freud, it was Jung himself was Siegfried. So in other words, all of this speculation, but here we can see, yeah, in a sense it was Jung himself, certain, you know, part of Jung. And so now the question arises, really, what does all this mean for us in a more precise fashion? Well, we know that we identify with certain attitudes and motivations which represent what nowadays so often ad infinitum and ad nauseam is called our self-esteem. You know, our self-esteem. And as long as we are identified with the part of ourselves that embodies these qualities, the hero who conquers the outer world, the exalted ego, the inner Siegfried, at some point, if there is to be an essential change, if, so to say, room is to be made for a different kind of self, then this inner Siegfried has to be slain, in order for the deep unconscious, the spirit of the depths, to become manifest. Now, slaying should not be taken too literally. It means that the self-esteem and ego complex has to diminish, has to become permeable, has to become acceptive of the deeper wisdom. We know from the editor's notes and quotations from various writings of Jung, Black Book, and otherwise, that Jung didn't even like Siegfried. It wasn't a very sympathetic figure to him. So there has to be a coming together of the valuable part, we might say the valuable part of the ego world that prides itself on its high knowledge and consciousness, which appears to be absurd to the ego. So there has to be a diminishing. There has to be it has to open up. It has to crack open. And indeed, it could be said, I think with a good deal of justification, that all the yogas, all the monastic spiritual exercises and the disciplines are designed to slay Siegfried. When the time has come in a person's life to let go of the heroic ego, then the slaying must be accomplished, and it requires all of the available resources of our consciousness to do it. And that is why, whom does he have as his helper? He has a shadow figure. This is one of those times when we need to enlist the aid of the shadow. It is maybe one of the first, at least symbolic ways in which Jung expresses the truth that we need the shadow in order to help us to accomplish certain very important tasks. If the shadow always remains in the dark, we don't have all of our resources at our command. And that is of great importance. The young, dark man in the vision is the shadow who becomes the helper. And Jung recognizes that what happened was necessary, and thus he experiences relief. He doesn't feel guilty, he doesn't feel disturbed about it anymore. He knows that this is what had to happen. The next chapter, which is chapter 8, is called The Conception of the God. Now, what we have in this chapter is the intimation of a new reality, a new way of being that follows upon the slaying of the hero. Jung uses numerous metaphors, mentions that the new God can only be discovered when one allows oneself to descend into the depths. He dwells at some length on the legend of Christ's descent into hell, the harrowing of hell, as a metaphor of the new God, the God who is about to resurrect, who descends into the darkness and acquires a knowledge of the darkness and of evil. So he says, if Christ had not descended into hell in the time, you know, when this legend puts it between his death and resurrection, then he would not have been a total or a complete savior. So the new God, the new Christ, attains to what Jung here calls ambiguity, namely the ability to function in light and dark, in order and chaos, in heaven and hell, with equal ease. We have a somewhat different version, and yet I think it is a version, of the old Gnostic Manichaean statement declaring that the darkness contains the captured seeds of light. And that, of course, in the legendary of the harrowing of hell, that is really what happens, because Christ goes to liberate the souls in prison. So we must seek the light not only in the light world, which is really a rather easy task at that, but in the darkness as well, otherwise we shall never know the light that shines in the darkness. So the new God is compounded, as it were, of white light and of dark light. That is my metaphor. That is not, in those words, is not in the red book. Now, we got to see a little bit of here of what Jung wrote himself. I must say that the God could not come into being before the hero had been slain. The hero, as we understand him, has become an enemy of the God, since the hero is perfection. The gods envy the perfection of man, because perfection has no need of the gods. But since no one is perfect, we need the gods. The gods love perfection because it is the total way of life. But the gods are not with him who wishes to be perfect, because he is an imitation of perfection. Imitation was a way of life when men still needed the heroic prototype. The monkey's manner is a way of life for monkeys. In other words, when we imitate others, the example that we imitate, we like try to be like somebody else, when really we ought to find out how we can be ourselves. That is to a major extent what he is saying here. And so the monkey's way of life is for monkeys, and for man, as long he is like a monkey. Human apishness has lasted a terribly long time, but the time will come when a piece of that apishness will fall away from men. That will be a time of salvation and the dove and the eternal fire, and redemption will descend. Then there will no longer be a hero, and no one who can imitate him, because from that time henceforth all imitation is cursed. The new God laughs at imitation and discipleship. He needs no imitators and no pupils. He forces men through himself The God is his own follower in man. He imitates himself. Now, of course, the question arises, what or who is this new God he is speaking of? The only feasible answer that it is the archetype which in his psychological writings subsequently, you know, later on came to be called the Self, with a capital S. That is the new God. This Self is compounded of conscious and unconscious, of low and high, of light and shadow. It becomes the imago Dei, the God image in the human. And when Jung subsequently translates the insights of the Red Book into alchemy, then the Self becomes what? The Philosopher's Stone. Why is the Self a compound of light and dark, of above and below, of male and female, and of the various opposites? Because it has to include everything. The Self with the capital S is a wholeness within the individual psyche. In Gnostic terms, it is the presence of the pleroma in us. And as such, it has to include elements of everything. So we labor in giving birth to a new God in us. And when this happens, then we no longer imitate various heroic images and personae, which is, of course, what we do all the time. We are imitators of the images of the persona, not just the imitators of other people, but we set up a Siegfried for us and then say, well, I am the professor. So when I talk to people, I should know a little bit about it. I was kind of a professor myself at one time, you know. And so we imitate our image of the professor. But of course what we are doing is we are putting on a charade. It's not really ourselves at all. Or whatever, you know, a woman with children will say, well, I am the great mom. I'm the great mother. Somebody else, I'm the great leader of man, I'm the great artist. But the fact is, we are none of these. These are the Siegfrieds to be slain. We have to be ourselves. And that self ultimately becomes the S with the capital S. We have to become an indissoluble wholeness. That is the new God within. And as Jung himself mentions several times, in anticipation, because he certainly could have not known that since the Nag Hammadi collection was not discovered yet, the saying in the Gospel of Philip, no longer a Christian, but a Christ. When you discover who that real presence and what that real presence is within you, then it's not a matter of the imitatio Christi, but it is the imitation of an external ideal, but it is the expression of the ideal presence within you. So that is the new God within. The slain hero eventually gives way to the God within. And so in a certain sense we might say that Jung is moving step by step toward the recognition that the way in which people have tried to perfect themselves, the way in which people try to lead a spiritual life, and for that matter an intellectual life, a moral life, was to a major extent by imitation, namely trying to conform to an external ideal. This is the great shortcoming, let us say, of the religions, for instance, that are often called ethical monotheism. Why? Because the important emphasis is placed on what? On something external to ourselves, which is a rule, which is a commandment. This is what you have to follow. This is how you have to behave. And this is a form of imitation. It is a lack of authenticity. the new God whom Jung advocates and who is the internal God does not do that. He expresses what is within him and no longer has to imitate anything external. And that's a very important issue. Now we come to a very powerful and mysterious element in chapter 9 of book 1, which has a strange title. Now these titles were not all given by Jung, but the title is called Mysterium Period Encounter. Not a mysterious encounter or an encounter with the mystery, but the mysterium and an encounter. And I will read at least the initial portion of this. On the night when I considered the essence of the God, I became aware of an image. I lay in a dark depth. An old man stood before me. He looked like one of the old prophets. A black serpent lay at his feet. Some distance away, I saw a house with columns. These pictures are very evocative. All I have to do is just close my eye and I can see the house with the columns. A beautiful maiden steps out of the door. She walks uncertainly and I see that she is blind. The old man waves to me. I follow him to the house at the foot of the sheer wall of rock. The serpent creeps behind us. It was kind of like a pet serpent, sort of like a dog or so. It follows you around. It would be kind of nice. The serpent creeps behind us. Darkness reigns inside the house. We are in a high hall with glittering walls. A bright stone, the color of water, lies in the background. As I look into its reflection, the images of Eve, the tree, and the serpent appear to me. It takes him back to the images of Genesis. After this, I catch sight of Odysseus and his journey on the high seas. Suddenly a door opens on the right onto a garden full of bright sunshine. We step outside and the old man says to me, "Do you know where you are?" And now it's a dialogue. So I will say, I am a stranger here and everything seems strange to me. Anxious as in a dream, who are you?" That's Jung talking to the old man. The old man says, "I am Elijah, and this is my daughter Salome. I, the daughter of Herod, the bloodthirsty woman." See, it is sometimes a bad thing when you know too much Bible. Then it beclouds your judgment. "Elijah, why do you judge so? You see that she is blind. She is my daughter, the daughter of the prophet. I, what miracle has united you?" "Elijah, it is no miracle. It was so from the beginning. My wisdom and my daughter are one." Mm-hmm. What kind of a wisdom is female? What kind of a wisdom is a daughter? I think the Gnostics know it as Sophia. I am shocked. I am incapable of grasping it." "Elijah, consider this. Her blindness and my sight have made us companions through eternity." "I, forgive my astonishment. Am I truly in the underworld?" And now there is Salome who steps forward and speaks. Rather forthright she is. I like forthright women like that. She comes up to Jung and says, "Do you love me?" Now, you know, that's cutting right to the to the important part. "And I, how can I love you? How do you come to this question? I see only one thing. You are Salome, a tiger. Your hands are stained with the blood of the Holy One. How should I love you? Now, I need to remind you, that of course, what he sees here is Salome of the Bible who causes the death of John the Baptist. But of course, there is a kind of a different mystical interpretation of that present here. How should I love you, Salome? You will love me. I love you. Who gives you the right to such thoughts? Salome, I love you. Leave me be. I dread you, you beast. That's a kind of a nasty way to deal with a lady, really. Salome, you do me wrong. Elijah is my father, and he knows the deepest mysteries. The walls of his house are made of precious stones. His wells hold healing water, and his eyes see the things of the future. And what would you give for a single look into the infinite unfolding of what is to come? Are these not worth a sin for you? Your temptation is devilish. I long to be back in the upper world. It is dreadful here. How oppressive and heavy is the air. Now Elijah enters the picture again. Elijah, what do you want? The choice is yours. But I do not belong to the dead. I live in the light of day. Why should I torment myself here with Salome? Do I not have enough of my own life to deal with? Elijah, you heard what Salome said. I cannot believe that you, the prophet, can recognize her as a daughter and companion. Is she not engendered from heinous seed? Was she not vain, greed, and criminal lust? Elijah, but she loved the holy man, namely John the Baptist. And shamefully shed his precious blood. Elijah, she loved the prophet who announced the new God to the world. She loved him, do you understand that? For she is my daughter. Do you think that because she is your daughter, she loved the prophet in John, the father? Elijah, by her love shall you know her. But how did she love him? Do you call that love? Elijah, what else was it? I'm horrified. He's kind of a little prig, he's up there talking to these great archetypal beings. I'm scandalized. Oh, I'm horrified. I am horrified. Who wouldn't be horrified if Salome loved him? Elijah, are you cowardly? Consider this. I and my daughter have been one since eternity. He brings that up again, that we were together. You pose dreadful riddles. How could it be that this unholy woman and you, the prophet of your God, could be one? Elijah, why are you amazed? But you see it, we are together. What my eye sees is exactly what I cannot grasp. You, Elijah, who are a prophet, the mouth of God, and she is a bloodthirsty horror. You are the symbol of the most extreme contradiction. Elijah says something very important now, which then is repeated. We are real and not symbols. That's quite an astonishing situation. So this is the famous story of Jung and Elijah and Salome, not forgetting the snake, who is the third of the party. Now, very, very quickly, you need to keep in mind that Elijah is not just one prophet. Well, of course, he is one of the four major prophets of the Old Testament, the 12 minor and four major. But he's really a very, very unusual prophet. For instance, it's generally believed in tradition that Elijah founded a school of the prophets on Mount Carmel. And that there he was anointing, initiating other prophets. So he's a prophet who is able to make other prophets. Now that's very, very unusual. And so his fame as the great archetypal prophetic figure continues for a very, very long time, all through the Middle Ages and so forth. He's involved in Rosicrucian lore, in all kinds of important documents. I well remember a late friend of mine who lived for a good many years in Greece used to tell me that the Greeks have many churches, chapels, you know, shrines, sacred buildings on the top of mountains. And says each and every one of them is named after Elijah. Mm-hmm. And the Greek word is Elias. And the ancient Greek name for the sun god is Helios. You see, the H, Helios, the H is not pronounced in Greek. And so, how does Elijah leave this world? He's the primary deathless one, because the fiery chariot comes and picks him up. And what does the sun god Helios ride through the sky? Fiery chariot. So there's a very ancient, very important archetype of light and power, you know, here. So it is generally believed by interpreters, for instance, that Jung enters the world of the archetypes as such here. It has also been suggested that Elijah disguise or a prefiguration for Philemon, who is to appear later. And Jung himself describes this as a play, a mystery. And he states emphatically that it is his own, not anyone else's. He says, it is my secret, not yours, what he now undergoes. So there is when one, you know, goes through, as I have, you studied these chapters, and you come up to this one, and there is an entirely different feeling about this chapter as soon as Elijah and Salome appear. There is something, just as I said, we are not symbols, we are real. You might say, well, aren't symbols real? Well, yes, but you know, that's another story. Maybe one way of looking at it in technical terms would be Jung later on spoke about the archetypal image and the archetype as such. This is the world of the archetypes as such. These are no longer just images. So once again, one gets the feeling that although he gives some psychological explanation, there is somehow more to the story than the explanations indicate. And Jung went on record later in life stating that the prophet Elijah was a highly important mythical personage, which probably did not prevent him, however, from being a historical figure also. He also called him a living archetype. In 1925, Jung referred to this encounter as, you know, that's not such a long time after the experience itself. He referred to this encounter as having been part of a descent deeper than all the earlier ones. He used the term that in this case he went down to a cosmic depth. And he also mentions that Elijah has something to do with what here is translated as forethinking. Well, that's forethought. This is the Gnostic epinoia. A very, very powerful form of the thinking function. And one may feel that it is related to the Greek epinoia of Gnostic fame. Wisdom manifesting in prophetic knowledge, which includes knowledge of the future. Salome, on the other hand, is associated by Jung, well, initially he says with pleasure, which is the dual, these are the dual opposites in ways of thought and feeling. So one would think that at some point Jung would have associated Salome with the anima. And of course, that was a discovery, not term, that came later. And why is Salome blind? Because she is unconscious. She isn't out in the focus of consciousness yet. Why does Salome says that she loves him, he being the ego? Because she wants to come. She wants to be closely associated. She wants to come into consciousness. She wants to come into the life of the individual. So, and eventually Jung speaks of the serpent as well, of which he was rather frightened initially, as one often is of serpents. He says, the serpent is the earthly essence of man, of which he is not conscious. Its character changes according to peoples and lands, since it is the mystery that flows to him, namely to the human, from the nourishing earth mother. So it is a sort of a trinity, the man of light, Elijah, the female, the woman of feeling, who is Salome, and the snake, who is really is sort of like their pet, because he supplies the third factor of energy that accomplishes the mystery. So there is a trinity, and the snake is a very important factor within it. We move on to the 10th chapter called Instruction. And in this, Jung confronts the archetypal pair, Elijah and Salome, and voices to them his confusion and disturbance. Once again, he has this great experience to meet these two, but he's shook up. Elijah and Salome try to assure him and comfort him, but really only with moderate success. It seems that the archetypal pair were planning a certain development for him, and that this had to do at least in part with the love of Salome for him, but he resists. He is too impressed by the bad biblical reputation of Salome as a wanton woman who, you know, demands the head of John the Baptist and then her stepfather has John executed. And Jung is sort of attracted to her and repelled by her at the same time. One thing I need to mention, however, that's very important, and that is that in both in the New Testament and particularly in the Gnostic scriptures, there is another Salome. And this Salome is a disciple of Jesus. And she is mentioned with Mary the mother and with Mary Magdalene and Salome. Now, it is of course quite likely and possible that Salome was not such an uncommon name, that it is another person. But you know, nomen is tomen. The name is a sign. And so it's very likely that there is at least a sort of a symbolic carrying over, and that we are not just dealing with the woman who presumably had to do with killing John, but we are dealing with the disciple of Jesus. Also, it's a kind of Gnostic thinking which the poets, you know, that's with a lot of the great poets of the late 19th century, very early 20th century, wrote all kinds of things about Salome, including Oscar Wilde, who wrote the libretto to the famous opera on Salome. Is that by Strauss? I think it's by one of the Strausses. Well, the big, very, very wild, very, very sensual opera that it just drove the people wild, drove the Puritans to great anger and others to great joy. You know. And there the notion arose in the minds of these poets that maybe Salome is doing something that needs to be done. And that, first of all, that Salome loves John the Baptist, but that she causes his death in order to make way for the other one to come, who is Jesus. So it's a little bit like Judas, as it emerged from the Gospel of Judas, where somebody who has been excoriated as an evil person turns out to be someone who is doing something for an important and a very good purpose. Now I'll just keep you a little bit longer today, because I think it would be a shame not to conclude this development which started with Elijah and Salome. And so we go to the chapter called Resolution. There we are. On the third night, deep longing to continue experiencing the mysteries seized me. The struggle between doubt and desire was great in me, but suddenly I saw that I stood before a steep ridge in a wasteland. It is a dazzling bright day. I catch sight of the prophet high above me. That's, of course, Elijah. His hand makes an averting movement, and I abandon my decision to climb up. I wait below, gazing upward. I look to the right, it is dark night. To the left, it is bright day. So once again, the light and dark, the yin and the yang, the opposites. The rock separates day and night. On the dark side lies a big black serpent. On the bright side, a white serpent. They thrust their heads toward each other, eager for battle. Elijah stands on the heights above them. The serpents pounce on one another, and terrible wrestling ensues. The black serpent seems to be stronger, as often is the case, you know. Evil is always seems stronger than good. The white serpent draws back. Great billows of dust rise from the place of struggle. But then I see the black serpent pulls itself back again. The front part of its body has become white. Both serpents curl above themselves, one in light, the other in darkness. Elijah is there and speaks to him. Elijah, what did you see? I saw the fight of two formidable serpents. It seemed to me as if the black would overcome the white serpent. But behold, the black one withdrew, and its head and the top part of its body had turned white. Elijah, do you understand that? I have thought it over, but I cannot understand it. Should it mean that the power of the good light will become so great that even the darkness that resists it will be illumined by it? Elijah climbs before me into the heights, to a very high summit. I follow. On the peak we come to some masonry made of huge blocks. It is a round embankment on the summit. Inside lies a large courtyard, and there is a mighty boulder in the middle, like an altar. The prophet stands on this stone and says, "This is the temple of the sun. This place is a vessel that collects the light from the sun." Now there are two elements in part very, very quickly because we are late. First is the struggle of the two serpents. The second is the revelation of the temple of the sun. The two serpents once again seem to refer to the struggle and the interaction of the opposites. The implications of this image are no doubt manifold, but Jung's explanation is no doubt very telling. The darkness almost conquers the light, but in the struggle it absorbs enough light to be illumined by it. Unconsciousness, that which is without light, always seeks the light, even though it struggles against it. So the fighting, however, is contact. In the course of the fight, one becomes somewhat like one's opponent. And this, of course, can exist on many levels. Now, the temple of the sun, a place where the force of the supernal light, the alchemists call Lumen Dei, is concentrated so it may flow into the earth. And the remaining portion of the story of Jung's experiences with Elijah, at least in this part of the book, has much to do with how this celestial light is channeled into the receptacle of earth. Now the temple, that of course has to do with the temple of the sun. Elijah now climbs down from his high perch in the subsequent passages and descends to the lower regions. He descends into a subterranean cave. And in so doing, he decreases in size and becomes a dwarf-like figure, quite unlike himself. Answering Jung's query, who he is, he identifies himself as Mime, which is the name of a dwarf in Wagner's Ring of the Nibelung, who is a sort of a chthonic craftsman. And it's by no means a terribly admirable figure at that. Here Mime explains to Jung that the light of the sun collected on the high rock is transformed into a kind of water and flows down into the earth in many streams. And the dwarf identifies the subterranean sources of the water by saying, "These are my wells. Whoever drinks from these becomes wise." So it's sort of an indication that the highest light of the world descends to nourish, which comes from on high, descends to nourish the world, and indeed the underworld. So in this process of emanation, the wisdom figure Elijah himself diminishes and becomes a reduced figure. But fortunately, it doesn't remain that way. Elijah recovers his own form when Jung's vision rises once more to a more exalted state. So Jung continues to complain to Elijah about how everything is still dark to him. Also, he wants to know where Salome has gotten. Elijah chides him, "How impetuous you are! What is up with you? Step over to the stone, the crystal, and prepare yourself in its light." So there is the crystal is obviously a seeing stone, where it induces visions. That's why he saw the scenes from Genesis and so forth there. Now ensues a large transformation scene that begins with images first of the Christ child with the black and white serpents in each hand. He sees the crucifixion scene, Christ's torment on the cross. He sees all these in the stone. Meanwhile, the Elijah serpent has appeared again and coiled itself around Jung's feet. It's quite a pleasant old snake. Now the great initiation scene takes place. And I wanted to conclude with this, so you have to pardon me for the time element. Jung spreads his arms out wide in a crucifixion mode. Salome draws nigh. The serpent winds himself around Jung's body, and Jung's face becomes the face of a lion. Salome tells him that the Virgin Mary is Jung's mother, and when he protests, you know, he's still very much the minister's son. He doesn't like these things being turned around. So when he protests, she tells him, "You are Christ." He feels crucified. The serpent squeezes his body fearfully. Blood flows from Jung's body. So now the serpent has shown another side of himself. Meanwhile, Salome is there and she holds fast his feet, Jung's feet, and wraps her black hair around them. After a long time, Salome cries, "I see light." Clearly, she is no longer blind. The serpent falls off Jung's body. Elijah appears, and his form shines like a flame. And Elijah then says to Jung, "Your work is fulfilled here. Other things will come. Seek untiringly and above all, write exactly what you see." This is the end of, really, in terms of the visionary story, really the end of book one, and it is really the great initiation of Jung. Now, what is this all about, very quickly? We shall probably never know a good deal of it, but it is clearly a very dramatic scene of transforming initiation. The story combines Christian crucifixion elements with the appearance of the Mithraic lion-headed god, Ion, replete with the serpent coiled around him. Very famous image. There are several famous statues of it throughout the world. Jung interprets the conjunction of the serpent with the lion as a way in which, once again, the opposites conjoin. Serpent, water, lion, fire, you know. The mystery occurs, however, when Salome reacquires her sight. That's when it all happens. Then the snake falls down, everything changes. The blind anima is no longer unconscious. Now, a quick reflection here. In 1925, you know, about 10 years after the event, Jung gave a partial account of this initiation in a seminar. And I think of very few people, about 15 people or so were in the seminar. It was published as Analytical Psychology in the 16 lectures. An empty person by the name of Richard Knoll came along, and he made a big deal out of this. Jung declared himself the Aryan Christ, you know, and all of that. And this, of course, was the great accusation against Jung. But, of course, there was a very fine and very courageous gentleman by the name of Mr. Sunu Shannasani, who defended Jung fiercely against Richard Knowles' accusations on the internet and everywhere. And he, by doing so, I think he acquired the love and the gratitude of the Jung family, who in turn did what? Gave him access to the Red Book. So you see, even like Mephistopheles, who always desires evil but still accomplishes good, Richard Knoll inadvertently contributed to this. Now, if that is not poetic justice, I don't know what is. And it ends, the book ends, book one ends with, "The mystery showed me," so says Jung, "in images what I should afterward live. I did not possess any of those boons that the mystery showed me, for I still had to earn all of them." So we need to keep in mind that initiation, by definition, means what? Beginning something. You know, people think, "Oh, I've been initiated. I got it made." But to initiate something is to start something. So this is where the really great work begins. But it was shown him, and he actually refers to the an apocryphal Gnostic gospel which was quoted by Clement of Alexandria and Strometheus, the gospel of the Egyptians. It's not the same gospel of the Egyptians that is in Nag Hammadi. And who does Jesus converse with there? A Salome. And what does he tell Salome? He tells her an abbreviated version of the 22nd Logion in the Gospel of Thomas, when the two are made one and the above have the law and male and the female become a single one. So he sees the relationship of that event with his initiation. So you might say that at this point he is at least given the vision how the complete transformation occurs within him, and how he is really headed now for the kingdom of the gods, no longer a Christian, but a Christ. So there are great and wonderful, extremely powerful things to come now in the second book, which we shall address ourselves to, God willing, a week from tonight. And I thank you very much.
Catalog number 200503. For more information about available lecture titles and for many other resources, visit gnosis.org. That's GNOSIS.ORG.